people pay good money to see this movie. When they go out to a theater, they want cold sodas, hot popcorn, and no monsters in the projection booth.
Everyone pretend podcasting isn't boring.
Turn it off.
契約は1年間、さまざまな女王様がその状況に応じて、ただし一度入会していただくと途中退会はできません。
少しの苦しみならそれは辛いとか、その苦しみもある限度を超えると喜びに変わるのです。
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me once again is Ms. Sam Deegan.
Hello.
Also back in the booth is Mr. Jim Vendiola.
Hey, friends. It's so great to be back.
We are kicking off a month dedicated to Japanese film with a look at Hitoshi Matsumoto's 2013 film, R100. That's the letter R and the numeral 100. It's the story of a man who makes a contract with an organization called Bondage. For a year, they will surprise him with appearances from a variety of dominatrices who will attack and humiliate him at random. When they begin to show up where he works and lives, he tries to cancel the contract but finds this impossible. We will be spoiling this film as we go along, so if you don't want anything ruined, please turn off the podcast and come on back after you've seen the film. It's actually pretty easy to find out there. We will still be here. So, Jim, this was a request of yours last time we talked. When was the first time you saw R100 and what did you think?
I saw this movie maybe 3 years ago because I was revisiting Matsumoto's Big Man Japan. And I happened to see that Sean Baker of Tangerine and Florida Project fame had like made mention of R100 on Letterboxd. And at the time it was on Hulu. So I pretty much started watching it without knowing anything about it other than it was the director of Big Man Japan. And I just thought it was really hilarious and irreverent and bizarre. And I really didn't know what the hell was going to happen from one moment to the next. And so, yeah, it's been stuck in my head ever since because I feel like at least stateside, it seems like not that many people have seen it. So particularly when the topic of BDSM or kink in cinema comes up, I usually end up mentioning it or recommending it.
And Sam, how about yourself?
I watched it purely for this episode because Jim recommended it. So this was a brand new watch for me.
This was also a brand new watch for me. And I'm curious with your first experiences watching this for both of you. When the movie started and it's playing along, I was taking it very seriously. And I'm trying to remember the moment when I realized that there's a lot of comedy in this movie, but it took a while for me to realize that things are supposed to be funny. I don't feel like I was just completely clueless that they might have been not as forthright with this being a comedy right up front. Felt pretty serious, but there's at least one moment where things just turned on their head and I said, oh, I'm supposed to be laughing at this. All right. And then the movie, I think it's the movie changed, not me changing, but then the movie just goes fucking crazy and just keeps getting crazier. Thank you so much, Jim. This was a joy to watch. I had a great time with this movie.
I'm glad. It doesn't seem, at least from a critical standpoint, that others like it as much. But yeah, I loved it when I first saw it.
So I went in cold, not knowing anything about it. But for anyone who hasn't listened to our past episodes together, I feel like we've gotten into this kind of annual habit of doing an episode on something kink related. So I assumed that there was maybe going to be S&M involved. But if you read the Letterboxd reviews for this movie, it's a journey because it seems like about 40% of the people gave it 5 stars and are obsessed with it and have never seen anything like it. And then there are a lot of people who I think maybe didn't get that it was supposed to be as much of a satire or a comedy and are mad about the depictions of S&M and kink, which was also how I felt in the first half an hour. But then once I realized what was going on, I was like, oh, this is delightful.
You don't know what to make of it at first. And I think, I don't know, Mike, when that point was for you, or even Sam, you said it was like after the first half hour, but I think I realized it was more of a comedy during the carousel scene where the purveyor of this organization, or at least the quote unquote boss, was introducing the various women in a carousel. But yeah, even at that point, knowing that maybe it's funny, you don't know if it at that point is going to be like a good depiction of BDSM, or at least utilized in a way that isn't horribly offensive to that community, especially.
It doesn't actually depict BDSM at all. What it does is it, which in a way makes it inoffensive because it's there as window dressing on the surface and there's no genuine eroticism, really. It starts off with, I think, the first kind of BDSM scene, which I'm using air quotes, even though I know everyone can't see me. He just gets the shit kicked out of him, which, thinking about it in retrospect, it is very funny. But watching it, if you think that some sort of scene is about to happen, it's, this isn't what happens. You don't get beaten up on a playground.
There's no safe, sane, consensual play here.
Not if it's going well.
We should set this up a little bit. We've got Nao Omori as Takafumi Katayama. We see someone in the bathroom smoking, and then we soon are introduced to one of our first dominatrixes, who I guess is the kicking queen. All of these dominatrixes have titles, though I have to say the subtitles and even the on-screen titles, if they were having on-screen titles for all of these people, I wasn't seeing them. And then when they were there, I'd say half the time they weren't being translated, but I could figure out, oh, that must be the whipping queen. That one must be the humiliation queen. Once we got to the gobble queen and, of course, saliva queen, I knew exactly who those people were. But Takafumi he's not single. He's married. His wife is in a coma. She's been in a coma for 3 years, I think they say, which is odd because he's got a son, Arashi, I believe is his name. And he keeps asking, like, when's mom going to come home? And I don't think the dad has told him that his mom's in the hospital. I think he said that she's on a business trip. So will she be home in a couple weeks? Oh, yeah. And he must keep doing this for like a whole period of 3 years. He also is joined by his father, who helps take care of his son. And Takafumi is a furniture salesman at a department store. So we get a little bit of that life, which is fun as well. And yeah, he just goes to work, goes to the hospital, goes back home, some sort of variation of that. And yeah, the first time we see him, he's with this woman and he's mansplaining Beethoven's Ninth Symphony to her and the Ode to Joy. She gets up and kicks him in the head.
She gives him his own Ode to Joy.
Oh boy. Oh boy.
So good.
We get to see her kick him down some stairs. And when he goes down the stairs, he looks up at her. She takes off her trench coat. She's dressed in full dominatrix garb. And this effect happens. And it happens so often in this film. And I didn't realize everything that was going on with this because I wasn't familiar with this actor's face at first, his face gets distorted and it looks like his cheeks fill up like Joe Shishido from Branded to Kill. And he gets these little waves that go out around his head. I don't think it's an orgasm, but it's definitely a connection arousal. That, oh, yes, yeah, major like arousal.
Euphoria. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And it's so funny that you mention that actor, because I think when his cheekbones expand and stretch out, he looks like Song Kang-ho. I cannot see Song Kang-ho.
He also looks a little bit like a turgid penis when he does that with the big swelling too, but that might just be me.
The reason, or I guess the moment I decided I was on board, is when I fully saw his face. I love Nao Omori. He played Ichi in Ichi the Killer. And when I first saw him, I was like, wait, I recognize this guy. And I picked up my phone to look him up. And then it hit me and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it's him. And he's so good at playing these kind of sad pervert characters. And this character here, like, I don't love the CGI effect with that sort of face smushing. His eyes get all black and there's like a wave in the screen behind him that you see later in the film pop up even when he's not on screen. Like if he goes in a building and there's a shot of a building, they let you see this sort of like rippling circle letting you know he's in there getting super horny.
It's like the same quality of effect from Donnie Darko over a decade ago, right? It's so bad.
It's bad, but it's less offensive, I think, because this is so comedic and they're not trying to be profound in any way, like something like Donnie Darko is. It's like they're just trying to be over the top. And in that way, it works.
It is very over the top.
We get a little bit of voiceover from him. We get, I'm guessing that this is a flashback where he goes to the club. It says bondage on the door. I'm saying club, but it's basically an office. It says bondage on the door. And then we'll see. And it took me a while to realize that all of the ladies have this B logo somewhere on them, a necklace, a belt, a suitcase filled with grenades, whatever it happens to be. And yeah, he signs the whole contract. All the rules are laid down. There's this whole no violence against them, no touching, no initiating. You will never know when they're going to show up. And you are bound by this contract for a year. And that's the whole premise and where they take this thing. Holy shit. I had no idea at the beginning of the film where this was headed. And I have to say, I guess it wasn't the carousel for me that tipped me off. And it wasn't even the weird face, any of that kind of stuff. I think it was all the way until he goes in for lunch one day while he's at work. He leaves work and he goes in for lunch and he starts eating sushi. And one of the dominatrixes comes in. And every time a piece of sushi is put down on his in front of him, she smashes it, and then he eats what's going on. And everyone in the restaurant is just, what the fuck is going on? But they keep serving him sushi, and she keeps smashing it. And I think it was all the smashing and the cuts that went along with. That's when it finally clicked to me. Oh, this is absolutely ridiculous. Okay, this is great.
And the silence of that scene, it's just her smashing the sushi.
No one says anything, and she does such a great job, or whoever is actually smashing that sushi, it's squashed. And I love that they show you, it almost seems like he's getting omakase for lunch because it's a single piece of nigiri at a time. And I love that they just show you every single, like, pretty recognizable types of fish smashed, all of them.
And it kind of still looks pretty edible.
He makes it work. For me, I think I started to guess that something was going on when early in the film, like you said, his father comes to visit for dinner because it's his son's birthday. And there's a point before his father leaves where nothing is happening. And he pauses very dramatically and says, an earthquake, like an earthquake's about to start. And they look at each other like, nope. It's nothing. And I was like, all right, something has to be, either there's going to be some crazy earthquake that kills everyone, or this is a signifier that something wacky is going on.
And that at one point in the movie, they introduce, is it five people that are watching the movie that we're watching? What are they, censors, or what are these people there for? But they are commenting on the movie as we are watching the movie, and specifically call out, what is it with this whole earthquake thing? Is this supposed to be symbolic?
That is such a nice touch, because like you said, the title is the letter R100, which is a rating system. And so what it means is this movie is not suitable for anyone under the age of 100 years old. And so the rating, I think having that kind of review board looking really awkward and uncomfortable and very like Japanese bureaucracy makes it even funnier. Once, I think it took me a while to figure out like, who are these people and what are they doing? But so funny.
Oh, yeah. No, that's the kind of thing, if you're not familiar with the rating system over there, that you either have to look up because they don't explain it to you. I guess one could draw the line between the title and the fact that the director is 100 years old, and the director of the film that the censors and we are both simultaneously watching, and that he thinks it's not suitable, or that you wouldn't understand his film unless you're 100 years old.
At one point, doesn't somebody in the review board say, like, how many 100-year-olds even are there?
Let alone ones that go to the cinema.
To me, the director, and please tell me if I'm wrong, he so looks like Seijin Suzuki to me. I know it's not him, but just the goatee and the hair, just he looked like that. And I'm like, yeah, I could see Seijin Suzuki making this movie.
Oh, for sure.
At 100.
At 100, yeah.
Especially.
His late in life comedic phase.
Once that sushi scene happened, then it is so balls out, because the next dominatrix that attacks him hops up in a fountain and grabs him and throws him under the water. She's basically drowning him. He sinks into a pool that is way too deep for what this fountain could be. And that's when the lines go off, and it's almost like a depth charge of him being so happy. And he comes back up and he's in a tub with his son. I was curious what you guys thought about the look of this movie, because there are so many scenes that just, they almost look like piss yellow. They're just so like oddly colored. And then other times it's, you know, looks very nice. But then other times we go back and it just looks so dingy. And I kept trying to figure out, is there a pattern to this? Or is it one of those things where it's like, oh, his day to day is so dreary until the dominatrix shows up and then color comes in? But I wasn't able to tie those things together at all.
Yeah, I feel like that when it is not that drab yellow, it doesn't look that much better. I think the decision for that look is the weakest thing for me. It's just not a fun movie to look at, which is unfortunate because it's such a fun movie, like plot-wise. Yeah, no, so I don't know. And it's the Alamo Draft House transfer, so I assume it looks pretty close to how it should look. I don't think it's the result of a bad transfer or anything, but I can't be sure.
I found it pretty unappealing to look at in a way that reminds me a lot of those 2000s Japanese horror movies, things like Tokyo Gore Police, that are just really heavy with bad CGI and digital effects. And they all have that kind of washed out grayish drab look to them.
That's so desaturated.
Yeah, unless there's a scene with a lot of blood and then it's heavily saturated. Yeah, definitely not my favorite looking film, which is a shame because it is a lot of fun.
After he visits his wife, and I don't think we ever find out why she's in the coma. I thought that was going to be another mystery to this. Oh, why is the wife in the coma and all this? Also, I don't know if it's just, he's pretty middle-aged, but the wife looked a little bit older, but I could just be like, that's her laying down and she doesn't do anything. Though at one point he thinks that she starts talking to him because he's in the presence of Voice Queen, who can impersonate anybody's voice. There's a scene later on in the film where she comes back, and it's so reminding me of Terminator 2.
What's wrong with Wolfie? I can hear him barking. Is he okay?
Wolfie's fine, honey. Wolfie's just fine. What are you?
If both the parents are dead.
Absolutely.
But we have that amazing montage where it's like him getting hauled into a van and you get the waves coming out of the van, or him going into a construction site and the waves come out from behind the construction site wall, and he's waiting in a bowling alley and waiting. And then it's just, oh yeah, no, that's part of the game. Sorry. We're not going to tell you every single time these people are going to show up or when they're not going to show up. So good luck with that. And yeah, once the voice queen shows up at the hospital, he gets so upset because now they have entered into his life. They've crossed that, what he considers a barrier, but they never agreed to, you know, won't interfere with my personal life. So yeah, when it's that, and then when the woman shows up at his work and just pops out of a stall in the bathroom and just starts whipping him like crazy, that was hilarious to me, especially when they are between blows, let's say, and the other bathroom door opens up and one of his coworkers comes out and again
is silent again, just like a trauma response.
Well, the use of silence in this is so funny. I think it's one of the funniest elements. And I didn't realize that the director, Matsumoto, is a comedian and pretty much only does comedies. But I'm glad I went in not knowing that. But he has really good comedic timing for a lot of these scenes.
That's probably why it's hard to determine as a comedy for a while, because it's so fucking deadpan. And with the ugly visuals, maybe that part of that decision also was like, you're not going to know what genre this is until we tell you.
Which is a bold choice. Expecting someone to watch a movie going in blind, not knowing, is this maybe more a pink film or a thriller? And nope, it's a comedy.
Also, back to the hyper specificity of these DOMs, not only is it one of the more absurd things in an otherwise already incredibly absurd movie, the fact that it's this year-long contract and he sells furniture, what is this an affordable thing? Because I feel like it would be like a Michael Douglas in The Game. You have to be like this very well-to-do, even old money person to have these delights, but this common man is...
Maybe there's a sliding scale.
That's right. It's like therapy. Yeah.
No money down. We'll get you in this contract.
Yeah, definitely therapeutic.
That's a type of therapy. And one of the things I liked a lot about it, I'm a sucker for melodrama that seems like it shouldn't belong in certain more obvious, or mixed with certain more obvious genres. And so to have this really over-the-top, funny kind of S&M comedy include these sort of heartwarming scenes about this guy who's miserable at work and is trying to raise his kid as a single dad and deal with his wife being in a coma, that I think about halfway through, we actually do see her father. And he has this whole conversation, a solo conversation with her, about how maybe it's time to unplug her because she's not getting any better. I felt like those are pretty effective scenes. And they provide such a nice balance in the first half before it gets completely bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
That reminded me of Audition in that way, which also may point to that visual aesthetic as well, even though I think Audition is a much better looking movie. But yeah, no, it's you almost see it going down that road with this sort of sad man trying to find solace in something casual.
Trying to find some joy. His very own ode to joy, even.
That's right. But only getting hints of earthquakes.
I keep saying like, oh, they crossed the line. And so he gets upset and he wants to cancel the contract. And I think the most poignant moment of this movie, it's bizarre to say, is he goes after he visits his wife in the hospital. At one point, he goes and buys these croquettes. And as he's walking home, he's crossing over some railroad tracks. And this woman comes out, this dominatrix comes out and just starts kicking him like crazy. And then we get the train goes by, she disappears, he goes home, and his son's, oh, what happened to the croquettes? They're all screwed up. And that's, you're talking about silence, this moment of pathos of, oh yeah, they're messed up. And it's just like, that seems to be the inciting incident for him to finally say, listen, I'm done with this. And Of course. No, you're not done with this. We'll tell you when you're done with this. A year has not expired yet, so you can't just cancel this out. And yeah, to me, that it totally does remind me of the game when it comes to those kind of things. Like, we're going too far, but nope. You are part of this. You've agreed to this. You have to fulfill this contract.
I also love that the first, it seems like a very Japanese thing to do. The first way he tries to get out of the contract is to go to the police station and report it. They take this incredibly detailed report, writing down everything that he said. And at the end, I'm sorry, I have now made myself laugh and can barely get this out, but at the end, the cop is, okay, so they're doing exactly what you signed up for. No minors are involved, nothing illegal. Best of luck, buddy. Enjoy your situation. It's not for everyone. But again, he basically says, I guess keep us posted if it gets worse.
And that's Hitoshi himself, I believe, the cop. Yeah. And then he compares it to pro wrestling, which is a funny little hint to the CEO who has not been revealed at that point, who's like played by a retired pro wrestler.
I didn't realize, like you, Sam, I went in completely cold, not looking up anything about this, anything about the director, the writer, anything. And so then while I'm watching the movie, I'm just like, what the hell else did this guy do? So I looked up and saw what you said, Jim, that he did Big Man Japan. And then it just was like, oh, this makes total sense. The whole thing of how they keep introducing the different kaiju in Big Man Japan, and they've got the stats and all that kind of stuff before each one of the fights. It's so reminding me of, oh, here's Saliva Queen, here's Kicking Queen, here's the, and I'm like, basically these women are kaiju. Oh,
CEO especially.
Oh my God.
But can we talk about Saliva Queen for a second?
Oh my God.
So okay.
That's when this movie really takes another turn.
It takes a wild turn, but also Saliva Queen is Naomi Watanabe, who is a really famous pop star comedian who's known as Japanese Beyonce. So to see her, I think because she did some comedic Beyonce impressions, not because she's like a Beyonce level singer, as far as I know. I think she's more known for her comedy, but to see her show up and before her, most of the dominatrixes are very reserved. Like, they don't express much personality. They don't say very much. Most of them are silent. And she's just so funny, just spitting saliva everywhere.
She almost steals the show.
She does.
And that's probably why they had to kill her.
Yeah, it's the longest scene of because he's tied up and getting spit on. And I know that spitting is very much a thing in the scene and everything, but I love when he's like, hey, you got to be quiet, my son's here. And the next thing you know, he comes in, the son, and Voice Queen is there again. Or no, he like thinks Voice Queen is there. And he's just like,
Voice Queen is there too.
Oh God. Cause he's, that's not him. That's not my son. And when they take off the blindfold, there's his son standing there. Cut to the son bound up with the same blindfold, like the mini version of his blindfold. This whole, I can't remember Japanese bondage.
Shibari
scene of him in the background just hanging there.
Dangling in the closet.
Never makes a peep at all. Yeah, with the ball gag in his.
And again, with the silence. Like,
I
thought I was going to pass out, like, when I first saw that scene. Like, I could not stop laughing. I was like, I cannot believe what I'm looking at right now.
You're watching a child in a bondage scene?
I know. And that it's actually funny, and they're, really like, pulling funny. It off.
I had a moment where it took me a second to register that the kid was tied up in the corner, and I was like, holy shit, what dark turn is this about to take?
Yeah. And then he gets a new nickname.
Yes, Slobber Boy. Because when he finally gets in the car and drives away, leaving a trail of slobber because his son's head's sticking out the window. It's, haven't you seen Hereditary? You need to get that kid's head back inside.
But I love that what they wind up doing with the kid is like, the kid is scared, but he's not like realistically scared. Like,
no.
I think that sort of grounds this in comedy more. But then the son starts having his own like euphoria CGI moments.
right after the woman says they're going to run him over.
Yes. Please tell me more.
Okay. Oh, God.
She uses the word like hit or something. Otherwise, we'll hit you. And then he has a little moment.
I'm probably already on a lot of watch lists. Yeah. I feel like I shouldn't say this, but it's like endearing.
They really pull it off. I'm like, yeah, I should not be dramatically moved in any way, or at least feel like they got it right. But here we are. Here we are fucking talking about it.
And God,
laughing about it.
If fucking Saliva Queen makes all of these drinks that would... And she's just there. Oh, here's one with, I don't know, avocado and all. And like, it's such a wide variety, a flight of different things to spit at this guy. And then she gets a little too cocky.
She winds up for a really big launch of saliva, and that's all she wrote.
After he said, because like his euphoria moment in that is, it can't be the real people because it's the father spits on him. I guess it's in his head. Like the father spits on him, the wife spits on him, his boss spits on him, the cop that we just saw spits on him, and then the waves come out again. But yeah, she winds up to spit from the farthest distance and just falls right off. And we have, I think, our first death in this movie, but don't worry, we're going to get a lot more.
Right. And then instead of blood coming out of her mouth in true genre fashion, it's just all this saliva.
Oh my God, yes.
It's like, yeah.
That's such
like
another
a river.
Magical moment. That's so much.
When the saliva just gushes out of her mouth, that was the moment I was like, okay, I'm in.
Oh yeah.
I'm fully in.
There's a musical sequence. She's dancing. I love the thing how they keep like showing her coming into frame from left to right. And I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So good. And yeah, she's just having a great time. She seems to be having the best time in this movie. And I love
100%,
it.
100%. Yeah. Her scene is absolutely perfect, especially at the beginning when the other dominatrix, I think it's the Queen of Voices, introduces her and reprimands her for not being polite enough. And
yes.
Every time she apologizes, she just spits. Yeah.
Yes.
And she took a cab there.
Oh, she did.
And the cab driver just waiting.
With her big Victrola that she has, has to wind it up. And of course, it's got the big B on there and everything. And then after she dies, we get a documentary about the Queen of Saliva suddenly, and we have all these interviews with her coworkers who now are at this big pool, and they have the yoga balls that you sit on or whatever those things are, but they're playing with those in the pool. And of course they're black and all the floaties are black and it's all matching the bondage gear and stuff. Oh my God. It is so good.
That's the set piece that I think looks the best and is the most carefully designed. I wish that there were more scenes that took place there because it is just a perfect set piece.
But again, they're juxtaposing the opia with the drabs, but I do wish it looked better.
And now he's on the run. He's got to get away because now he's got two women that are dressed like Diabolique or Diabolic after him. I didn't expect a car chase in this film, but suddenly we have it. And yeah, we got Slobber Boy just leading the path.
Leaving a trail.
For me, where it starts to come off the rails is in that last half an hour, because they introduce some plot elements that I think don't get followed up on. This guy who shows up a couple times. The first, like a guy shows up to help him and to say, we're investigating this bondage club and you need to get out of it before they target your family and ruin your life. But the first time the guy shows up, he's pretending that he wants to buy a mattress. And he makes him lay down next to him on the bed to make sure it's big enough for two people.
When he rolls over and falls off the bed, I laughed out loud again.
So did I.
We don't know what this guy's deal is.
Am I wrong? Does he not? He doesn't show back up, right?
He's the one that shows up and calls him Slobber Boy, I thought.
Yes. And he says he's going to help him. He lets him take his motorcycle. And then I think he just disappears.
Yeah. I want to say he answers the phone at some point when they're trying to find him, trying to find our main character. But I could be wrong about that.
But they never, it like, my impression was, oh, we're going to meet some sort of rival organization trying to take down the Bondage Club, but then that never happens.
And that he takes Arashi, the son, away, and I don't know if we ever see Arashi. We do see Arashi again in the final sequence of the movie, so he must be all right, and we'll get there with the final sequence of the movie, but yeah, we don't really see him hand the kid back over again. There's a lot of stuff happening in this last bit. I'm on a mission to fight antisocial elements. No time to explain.
I wonder if it was cut down.
It could be.
In meta fashion, because the censors did want to cut it down or do something to it.
That would really make sense. And I almost feel this movie's tagline should be like, it got too kinky and now you're upset. Which the cop 100%. Says to him.
Yeah, Arashi runs away. The government guy gives our main character his motorcycle. And while that's going on, Arashi runs past this gate. And does he go to the hospital or does our main character go to the hospital? I think he goes to the hospital after he has his euphoria moment when the woman is yelling at him on the street about how they almost hit him.
I think you're right. I think Arashi goes to the hospital.
Yeah. Because there's his story going on, though not as much. There's our main character's story. And then back at the pool, our guy who we thought was representing the Bondage Club finds out that the CEO is going to come and take care of business. And of course, he just panics to hell. And we get to see her plane come in. And holy shit, I was unfamiliar with this actress before. I am not a big wrestling guy, but Lindsay K. Hayward, how tall is she? She's got to be over 7 feet tall. 6'9"?
She's supposed to be, character is supposed to be 7 foot tall, 7 feet tall. She's 6'9", and she's actually the Guinness World Record holder for tallest woman in a leading role.
Wow.
What?
But apparently,
she's the same height as George Eastman.
Yeah, it makes sense because she's wearing heels and also she's surrounded by, and this is not supposed to be offensive, but she is surrounded by Japanese women. So when she comes in and inspects the troops at one point, she's walking past all of these women dressed in that same diabolic ninja mask type stuff. It's just, oh my God, she towers over everyone.
Yeah, it's like the totally. Yeah, no, it's like the visual sight gag from fucking Mr. Baseball and Lost in Translation, where you like put a tall white dude among a bunch of Japanese people. And in this case, it's obviously like Hayward, but no, it's so fun. Also, apparently she is 3/4 inch shorter now because of a slipped disc.
Oh, poor thing.
Yeah.
Probably from the explosive ending of this film.
Yeah, it could
Although I don't know if either of you will remember this, but there's this amazing 90s sketch comedy show called The State.
Oh, God. Yes.
Her arrival reminded me so much, and I haven't seen this in over a decade, if not more, but there's this hilarious episode of The State where there's this whole thing. They're working in this fast food restaurant and everyone is terrified of the owner showing up. It's like first the manager comes and they're scared of the manager. But when the owner shows up, that's when shit gets real. And it reminded me so much of when she shows up and everyone's just running in terror.
only for her to jump in the pool several times.
So many times.
What the fuck?
At first I thought, because I watched this on Tubi, which I don't understand how they have every single film. Like, how do they pay licensing fees? Let's not ask. But I thought that maybe for a second there was some sort of glitch because it just keeps repeating. But it's just when you realize what they're doing, it just gets funnier and funnier. It's like she's raged face diving in the pool.
I believe it's when Arashi comes to the hospital and goes in, and I'm guessing it's the hospital where his mom is at. Maybe? Question mark. I think it's him going in and sees the Queen of Gobbling, which is the funniest special effect. It looks like a yokai type thing. Like I'm trying to remember the Takashi Miike film, where it was like the all
yokai
of
yokai monsters.
Yokai monsters, yeah. And she looks like one of those. She has this huge face and it's just like feet sticking out of her mouth and trying to fight and everything. And I'm just like, I didn't expect Vor to be in this movie.
There you go. Another
there
kink.
There it is. Yeah. Another kink.
Hashtag representation.
I would say typically in any erotic or BDS film, if I heard that there's a character named the Queen of Gobbling, this is not what I would have imagined, but it's so funny.
And yeah, also, I think she shows up at one point and eats our main character's father before he then has perfect headshots to her and the Queen of Voices, because yeah, that's the whole Terminator 2 sequence. The pool jumping, the CEO calling him up to scream at him. And at first I was like, is she a terrible actress or is this just we're playing it over the top? And I think we're just playing it over the top. I don't know. I haven't seen her in anything else, but I think she just is screaming and yelling on purpose. And really just every time she's on screen, she just gets louder and louder.
I think maybe Jim said this earlier, she's not a person. She's like the kaiju final boss. She, all she does is scream and do rage-related things.
No, it's perfect for her character, perfectly performed. And she's like in a few other things, which I haven't seen. So she can't be like that consistently in like five different things. Maybe she can. Maybe that's her thing.
And it's so nice that I believe it was the Queen of Voices, or maybe it was the Goblin Queen, left a whole case of grenades at the house. So our hero...
What the hell is that?
So convenient.
Our hero gets to lob grenades at all of the ninjas that are about to attack, all to the strains of Beethoven. And when our final boss faces off with our hero, and he... As he's flinging the grenades, that's when he has his euphoria moment. And we get like a flashback to the guy who runs the whole bondage organization. And I don't remember him saying this whole thing about in the end, a masochist becomes a sadist, because when he faces off with the CEO, we don't see what happens, but we see those marks, those euphoria marks. And then they all start to get timed out to the fourth movement of the ninth, and suddenly it's the Ode to Joy with those little beep, beep, beep. It's so good.
I really wish that they would have shown what was going on inside the cabin, if only to have a little homage to Ichi the Killer, where he is, of course, this violent, unpredictable sadist who just can't help himself.
No, totally. I love the montage cut to Ode to Joy. I wish it was better. Like when I watched it again, I was just, there doesn't really seem to be a logic to the way that they're assembling these images, but it's fun nonetheless. And it's a satisfying enough culmination to what's been going on in this movie. But I'm like, I remember this movie being a little more bonkers than the montage right now.
I didn't love it, but it's way funnier than I was prepared for. I think it just comes apart at the end because it does go into that kind of Tokyo Gore Police territory where there's a lot of CGI and the violence is so over the top as to be cartoonish, maybe in a sloppy way, but still very funny.
I guess he has such a good time with the CEO that he gets pregnant. Because the guy who runs bondage, I'm trying to remember what he says, but it almost sounds like the masochist gives birth to the superior sadist. And I'm like, oh, does he literally mean give birth? Because I thought our main character was turning from a masochist to a sadist in that scene. Like the what's happening behind that those walls where the lights are glowing and the euphoria is coming out. And we're hearing Ode to Joy. Is this what's happening? But I'm thinking it's more literal that he is going to give birth to the superior sadist now, and now he's pregnant with the superior sadist.
Yeah, it's like a fucking prophecy, which is like, what else are they going to do for the end of this movie? Let's just
Lisa put in this, like,
big supernatural element.
Have some adorable family photos.
The music's all jaunty, crazy, happy. You know, I'm like, whoa, this music is nuts. Then we get a shot inside of the movie theater where our director smiles. His eyes turn black, his cheeks get all puffy, and he has his little moment of ecstasy right there. But there is a nice stinger scene after the credits where it's the five people that have been watching this movie that we've been watching standing around still and just angry that they had to put up with this whole thing.
But not us. Not us.
No.
We're laughing.
I had a great time. This was so much fun, Jim. Thank you so much for this.
I'm so glad.
Oh.
And I'm glad we were able to, continue. I think with the exception of last year at Marion Bed, every other time we've recorded, it's been some like kink related or BDSM related thing.
Yeah. To Sam's point, it's kinky. They're dressed as dominatrixes and everything, but it's not what we have been playing with. This isn't like a Duke of Burgundy. This isn't real BDSM. It's like all the trappings of it. And I think at first it's supposed to be like, isn't this outrageous? But then it becomes outrageous in a different way. It becomes outrageous rather than, ooh, this is shocking or something. It becomes outrageously funny. And using some of these trappings of BDSM, oh, you're not supposed to ask questions. The guy is just supposed to be passive and let this happen. And it just takes it and plays with that theme to me. At least that's how I'm seeing stuff.
Yeah, I definitely saw it the same way. And it's funny because a lot of the negative critiques that I saw when I glanced at the Letterboxd reviews were basically, it made me feel like maybe some of them didn't actually finish the film because it was very, what is with this weird use of S&M and why is this film trying to be so shocking just for the sake of being shocking? And it's not trying to be shocking at all. It's trying to be hilarious.
Right. At first, I was expecting another, what was that movie? Tokyo Decadence. Remember that one? And where it was like, oh, this woman, she's doing this and da 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 da. And it was like so controversial when that was showing back in the early 90s, I want to say. And I was like, oh boy, is this going to be another thing? Is he going to eat out of a dog bowl and all this kind of stuff? Or is it going to be, again, to your point, Jim, is going to turn into Audition? Like, what's going to happen with this thing? And that they went so far away from my expectations. And I honestly hope that people haven't listened to this podcast without seeing the movie, because it is such a treat to have that comedy exposed and just to be like, whoa. I didn't expect this, whether somebody's as stupid as I am and it takes them like 30, 40 minutes to figure it out or catch on a lot quicker. I still think that it's such a great ride to be on to have that exposed to you.
Yes. I honestly feel bad because anytime I tried to say something about a scene during this episode, I just wound up making myself laugh.
Yeah.
That should be an endorsement enough. You don't even need to listen to what we're saying. You just turn the episode off, watch the fucking movie.
And then listen to the episode.
Yeah, and then laugh
and
with us.
We'll make you laugh all over again.
Right. No, it is the type of movie where you just recall it and you're like, I can't believe like my eyeballs like looked at that and I have to laugh again. Like the slobber boy thing, him dangling in that fucking closet. I kid you not. Like, I just did not know when I was going to stop like laughing from that the first time I saw that. It's unbelievable.
The blindfold that they have on both of them has like the big goofy eyes on it. So at first, this is funny that they're putting this blindfold on our main character, but then when they have the miniature version for Arashi,
oh my
they just
God.
Have it. They have it in their kit.
And
know?
He doesn't even take the blindfold and ball gag out when he throws the kid in the car. Leaves him. Doesn't put any clothes on the kid because Arashi's walking around for the rest of the movie in his underwear. Yeah, like you said, Sam, at first I was like, oh yeah, this could be like an Ozu or Mizoguchi film. With like family drama and all this kind of stuff. The wife's been away for 3 years. This guy's only outlet is this club. And what happens when the family finds out, or will they find out? And we have to keep this secret. Yeah, it's not that. It's not that movie.
And you know what? I'm happy about that right now. I think I definitely needed a movie that made me laugh as hard as this one does.
I've seen Big Man Japan. I haven't seen the director's other two films, Symbol, and I'm trying to remember the name of the other one, Scabbard Samurai. So
these
one
are
of these
the only
days,
two I've seen.
Yeah. I got to check those out because if I had that much fun with this, and I remember liking Big Man Japan, I don't remember loving it, but I remember liking it quite a bit. And also just that idea of, because it's like Big Man Japan, people hate him, right? Because he keeps destroying stuff.
I think so.
It's been a while since I've seen the movie, but I'd like to check that out. And I didn't realize it's the director as Big Man himself.
I feel like that's typical Stephen Chow fashion, is if you're going to helm something, you also need to be front and center.
Mm-hmm.
100%.
We're going to take a break and play a preview for next week's show right after these brief messages.
この度は銀影株式会社さんが老朽化の著しい現撮影場を惜しくも閉鎖することとなりました。今回の企画はそのメモリアルとして創立70年の歴史を支えた大スター。
ごっつ難儀なとこで隠居暮らしとは偏屈なバーハンやな。
今度行ったら殺すぞ。バーハン、
はじめまして、藤原千代子です。二度とこの手にできる思わなかった。
大事なものだったのでは。
一番大切なものを開ける鍵さ。
一番大切なもの。
それから映画の世界に入ったの。
そうでしたか。鍵の君を開くために。
そう、私一目あの人に会いたいんです。なんだって私なんかに構うんだ。
お姉さんがその男を助けようって気持ちと何が違うってんだ。
その子何か隠しておる。
あの星空を君にも見せてあげたい。
生きてるか死んでるかもわからないじゃないか。
ジョーさ
ん、私行きます。必ず会いに行きます。
ごっつドラマティックや。
え、
俺はこのシーンを劇場で53回泣いたんだ。
That's right. We'll be back next week with a look at Satoshi Kon's Millennium Actress, where we will have a lot more earthquakes, real ones this time. Until then, I want to thank my co-hosts, Jim and Sam. So, Sam, what is the latest with you?
We recently did, for my podcast, Twitch of the Death Nerve, an episode that's a total change of pace opposite from this one, about Solo, that I am very proud of. And our next episode, I don't know if it will be live by the time this goes live, but a certain projection booth host will be on our next episode. So pay attention to both of those. And I guess the only other thing is a book that I co-wrote and co-edited that Mike also contributed to, called Revolution in 35mm, is up for pre-order and will be out in the fall. So I will be annoyingly plugging that heavily for most of this year.
Hell yeah.
I'll be sure to add a link to the show notes for that one. And Jim, what's happening in your world?
A little while back, I produced a short that was a body horror short about kombucha. And so that's starting to make the festival rounds. And we just got news of a pretty special premiere, which I can't talk about. So that's cool. That's directed by Jake Myers. And as far as my stuff, I just got into talks with a producer about doing like a horror anthology. And so that is to be discussed further, but it has a really fun theme, which I can't mention now, unfortunately, but it's going to be fun. I'm excited about that. A TV show that I have in development that had some support from Warner Brothers a few years back is still making the rounds, and we're having fun conversations about that. So maybe that's a TV show people will get to watch at some point, and I can stop taking meetings about it endlessly over the course of years. Just like the two feature films I have that I've been working on forever. But the the feature I'm most excited about that I might be able to shoot this year is queer body horror thing that's Catan meets Seconds. A lot of slow burn things. So
nice. How's your pickle?
Pickle is like out in the world. It's been online since last summer and it just had a little one-off screening in New York. When was that, Sam? In January? That's God, when that, Sam and I met for the first time.
Oh,
that,
cool.
It seems like it was 6 months ago, but yes, January.
You know, it was only 2 months ago. Jesus.
2024, hell of a year so far.
Yeah. What a ride.
Thank you so much, folks, for being on the show. Thanks to everybody for listening. If you want to hear more of me shooting off my mouth, check out some of the other shows that I work on. They're all available at weirdingwaymedia.com. Thanks especially to our Patreon community. If you want to join the community, visit patreon.com/projectionbooth. Every donation we get helps the Projection Booth take over the world.
わかってんの？どうなの？